Science Talks is recorded at the Legacy Music Recording Studio in Lewisville, Texas. Ben Robertson is our sound engineer, and you've been listening to Becerro, composed by Brian Pinkelman and performed by Brian Pinkelman on piano and Logan Pinkelman on the bassoon. Welcome to Science Talks, a podcast where we discuss big topics in science and speak with experts about their latest publications. My name is Dr. Deanna Sober, and I'm an associate professor of biology at the University of Dallas. Each week on Science Talks, we will feature one scientist and break down a recent publication. I aim to bridge the gap between the conversations that only scientists have and assist in distributing that information to a wider general audience. This week, we are with Dr. Caden Martin, a postdoctoral fellow at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. Dr. Martin graduated from Oregon State University with a PhD in ocean, earth, and atmospheric sciences. Dr. Martin has 7 peer-reviewed articles that document the use of ice core data to better understand climate variability across geographic regions and time. Today, we will be discussing ice cores, what they are, and what they can tell us about the Earth's climate before the time humans had instruments to measure things like temperature and greenhouse gases. In this episode, you will learn about global climate change and how we know what we know. As part of that effort, we will be reviewing one of Dr. Martin's most recent articles titled, "Greenland Ice Cores Reveal a South to North Difference in Holocene Thermal Maximum Timings," published in the scientific peer-reviewed journal Geophysical Research Letters in December 2024. I should note that this podcast is separate from my teaching and research at the University of Dallas. However, it is part of my effort to distribute both scientific knowledge and an understanding of the scientific process to the general public. And now we will begin our chat with Dr. Caden Martin. Welcome, Dr. Martin, to Science Talks.
Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. So I actually wanted to start off, and you and I had discussed this a little bit over email, but about the process of peer review. So last week, I had one of my students that came to me and said, you know, I'm having an issue. My parents, they just don't believe science. They don't think that, you know, what all the scientists are uncovering is all biased and that peer reviewed is rubbish because the scientists get paid to do peer review. And I was like, nope, not true. A lot of us, of course, you know, and I've had discussions with other scientists in the field because, you know, of course, working for free is not something that anybody really wants to do. But I was telling her, you know, that nope, you know, I've never been paid for a peer review that I've done, and that's an important part of the peer review process. So how about you tell us just a little about your experience with the peer reviewed process so far?
Yeah, so I have been lucky to be a peer reviewer twice. I've had a couple papers that haven't been peer reviewed. They kind of been more public general information or like educational magazines, but a lot of them have been peer reviewed. And it's such an important part of the academic process. It's been really fun to be on both sides of the review, to have something that's kind of in your wheelhouse. Some things might not be directly in your wheelhouse, but you have to really do a lot of research, like where the state of the field is, to be able to provide comments. So it's way more than just looking at that individual paper. You really need to get a full lay of the land before doing it.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't realize is that when you do get asked to peer review an article, It depends on, like you said, how much in your wheelhouse it is, but there are times where you can spend like 10, 20, even 30 hours reviewing a paper if you're doing it properly. And we don't get paid to do this. So
for
those of you that don't know about the peer review process, what happens is we collect data sets and then we write those data sets into a manuscript and we submit it to a journal. And if the editors agree that that would be a good publication possibly for their journal, they send it out to 2 to 3 other experts in the field that they identify. We can suggest reviewers, but a lot of times they may not even choose those reviewers. So they are independent reviews. And we also have moral ethics that we have to follow. So for example, I could not ethically review, for example, one of my students' papers. So I currently have a student, a former student, she's getting her PhD at a different institution. And we don't actually have a graduate program at the University of Dallas. My entire lab's run by undergrads, but I would not feel comfortable reviewing even her paper, even though she's at a totally different institution and doing a different paper, because I might have bias. And so one thing that we are always concerned with in science is reducing bias to the greatest degree possible. And that is a moral and ethic that we have to uphold. So I can confirm, and I'm a little bit further on in my career, so I've probably reviewed over 30 articles at least, maybe more. I haven't counted, but I just got asked to review one actually yesterday, and I haven't agreed yet. But but it is one of those things that, you know, we can't do, even though we can't get paid to do, even though we would like to get paid to do it. So it is important, because you could then have leverage if we were paid. So I just wanted to confirm that. Okay, so we are going to start talking a little bit about your work here. And I always ask, the first question is, what is the story behind this paper? There's always a story, I feel like, behind papers. How did this paper come to be?
So this this paper is actually the second chapter of my dissertation. And it was kind of following on from the first chapter, which turned out to be, you know, three and a half years of work, where we did thousands of measurements to find out the question we were actually trying to figure out. The answer was no. We thought we were to solve this glacial climate mystery. It's like, actually, it's really not that interesting, which in itself is a very interesting answer. So this was kind of trying to continue that question down the road. And this also turns out that the original question we were trying to ask, we also really weren't able to solve. So we had this really big data set, and we kind of just had to sit down with it and be like, okay, what's, you know, there are so many more stories in this climate record than the original thing we were looking for. So how can we just try to find the stories it's trying to tell? And it led to the Holocene.
Okay, so,
so really totally opened this new door.
Yeah, what is the Holocene?
Yeah, so the Holocene is the current interglacial period that we're living in. So climate over the past 800,000 years, and before that, we've gone through these ice age cycles. So we have very extensive periods of ice cover over North America. There's expansions in South America, really expansion of global ice systems. These are what we think of as glacial periods. So the last ice age at the LGM, so the last glacial maximum, you know, sea level was 120 meters lower than it is today, because you trap all that ocean water on land in the form of ice. The climate system is incredibly different. And then about starting at around 20,000 years ago to about 11,000 years ago, we transitioned from that really ice-extensive period into a period that's more like today. There's less, we don't have these massive ice sheets over North America. And that's what we would kind of define as the Holocene, is this most recent period of low ice volume.
Very good. And then you're using ice cores, and I know a lot of your work has surrounded ice cores. So can you tell us, what is an ice core?
Yeah, so ice cores can actually come from effectively all over the world, but we really care about these incredibly cold places like Greenland and Antarctica, where ice really historically doesn't melt. So we have snow that's accumulating seasonally. So if you're constantly building up snow in Greenland or Antarctica, but there's really no melting going on, that snow will just continue to build up and build up and build up and build up. And it will eventually condense under its own weight. And when it does that, you have this sort of nice fluffy snow that's being transformed into ice. And when it undergoes that process, it actually traps air from the atmosphere. It takes, you know, the snow takes one last gulp of air, preserves it in a bubble as it transforms into ice. And then as long as that ice doesn't melt, it'll keep that bubble preserved. And then we can collect the ice, melt it, and release the gas and measure it. So what an ice core is that we're starting effectively at the surface of the ice sheet. We drill down over 3 kilometers to the base of the ice sheet and collect ice along the way. So through that, we can go back, you know, roughly 100,000 years in Greenland, and now most recently, a little over 1 million years ago in Antarctica. So it's a really incredible climate archive.
I saw that. They just a couple of weeks ago extracted the biggest one, right, from Antarctica.
Yep. Yep. That goes back about 1.2 million years continuously. So you can start it today and count your way back 1.2 million years. It's really incredible.
A lot of people do think that when we talk about climate and we say, you know, 800,000 years ago, this is what the CO2 levels were, that they're just estimates. So I think that's really important to highlight the fact that it's not an estimate. It's an actual measurement because we have trapped air in the ice that we can measure. Mm-hmm.
And a really important part of that is we actually have an overlap period where we have air trapped in ice at the same time period where we've been able to measure CO2 in the atmosphere directly from Hawaii. And we can see that it's a one-to-one. We are exactly measuring in ice what we're seeing in the atmosphere today. So we're very confident that what we've measured in the past is accurate.
Yes. And I love that data set out of Hawaii. I show my students that every year. In fact, I have a running total in my Gen Bio class. I actually screenshot it on the same day that I teach about, you know, global climate change in my Gen Bio class. And so I have like a running total on that same day every single year.
Yeah.
And I am trying to explain to the students it's not going down. And the highest level that we're seeing is right around 280 parts per million, 300 parts per million. And we're, I think I just checked a week ago, we're at 426 parts per million. So, I mean, it's way above the what we're seeing in the last approximately million years. All right. Very good. So you're able to see time, you're able to see and actually measure exact greenhouse gases. So can you explain for us, first of all, what is a greenhouse gas and why are we concerned with things like methane?
So a greenhouse gas is, it's a compound in the atmosphere that's very, very effective at absorbing radiation. So temperature, like thermal radiation. So actually one of the biggest greenhouse gases is water vapor. And it's actually a really important substance for keeping the planet habitable, but it's also very, very sensitive. So if you have a little too much of a greenhouse gas, you're going to be trapping more thermal radiation coming off the planet. And that just emits it right back to us. So it's effectively a blanket around the planet that's trying to keep it warm. But if you have too many of those blankets on, the planet's just going to become warmer and warmer and warmer. And we know that greenhouse gases over time will change, and they'll change naturally. So on geologic timescales through changes in volcanism, changes in weathering. So these are the kind of natural pushes and pulls on the carbon system. So most of the greenhouse gases are carbon-based. There's some nitrogen compounds as well. But it's kind of this natural push and pull trying to balance the system. But we know, like you're saying, 420, 430 parts per million is way higher than we've seen from the direct measurements of the past atmosphere.
Now, moving on a little bit more to the paper, can you tell us what specifically were you trying to address in this particular paper?
Yeah, so this paper is largely looking at the Holocene thermal maximum. So this is also kind of a period called the Holocene thermal conundrum. So during this transition period from the last ice age towards climate conditions more similar to today, if you have a climate model, so a simulation that can really represent this transition on its own, the global temperature just kind of steadily increases from the onset of that interglacial period towards today. It's just this nice, you know, gradually warming towards today. But if we look at a lot of the proxy records, so a lot of the evidence of past temperatures, we see that the early Holocene, right when we come out of that ice age, is actually quite a bit warmer than it is during the late Holocene, so during the pre-industrial period. And this mismatch between our proxy evidence and our ability to model this transition is a really, really key. I think of it as this dispute in our own climatological backyard, mm-hmm. where the models are saying one thing, the proxies are saying another, and kind of trying to get at the bottom of that is a really important climate question.
Very good. So that pretty much is what an introduction might be like in a paper. So I think we're going to transition on into your methods. So how did you go about collecting the data then for this?
So luckily, the ice core community is really, really good at preserving records. So I didn't need to go to the field. I didn't need to spend, 3 years in Greenland drilling for a new core. I worked on the Greenland Ice Sheet Project 2 ice core, so the GISP 2 ice core, along with the North Greenland Ice Core Project and the North Greenland Eemian Ice Drilling Project, so North Grip and Neem. And those are stored by our Danish colleagues. So all of these ice cores have already been collected, and I was able to sample them to try to get some discrete samples in order to make these measurements. So I measured atmospheric methane, and we actually broadly use methane as a chronological marker. So it helps us understand the age of the ice very well, because there's these relatively large variations in methane that we can use as kind of like a barcode to scan our age to understand it. And then we are able to generate temperature by looking at an isotope of nitrogen. And that's it's a relatively complicated proxy. So what that's actually doing is looking at that snow to ice transition. So as the snow is being compressed and turned into ice, that process is actually very strongly dependent on temperature and what we call accumulation or precipitation, the amount of snow that's falling. So we have this process that's very dependent on climate. And if we can model that process through fern densification, so that snow to ice transition zone is called the fern, if we can get a good understanding of the conditions that led to that transformation, we can back out the temperature and precipitation amounts. And we can do that through the isotopes of nitrogen and through something called delta age. So that's the difference between the age of the bubble and the age of the ice that holds that bubble together. And that's a very kind of fundamental ice core proxy.
Do you see large differences between the bubble and the ice that holds it?
It can be. So during an ice age where it's really cold and there's not a lot of precipitation, that age difference can be greater than 1,000 years.
Wow.
But during an interglacial, that drops down really quickly to about 200 years. So it kind of reflects just how quickly you're flushing snow through the ice sheet system.
Very good. And then I saw that you had 3 different locations. So where in the world are these ice cores stored?
Yep.
And then where did they come from?
So maybe I'll flip that. And the ice cores that I'm looking at are coming from Greenland. Mm-hmm. So the 3 cores are kind of representing this, what we call a transect. So it's kind of this pathway along Greenland, starting from the summit of Greenland at the GISP 2 ice core. And we kind of follow the mountain range that the ice sheet is below, or the ice sheet is sitting on top of. And we go northwest to North Grip, and then farther northwest to Neem. So we're kind of looking at how climate is changing as you go from the tippy top of Greenland towards one of its northwest flanks. And then these ice cores are stored. So the GISP 2 ice core was drilled by a US team. So that's stored at the National Science Foundation's ice core facility in Colorado. And then North Grip and Neem were drilled by our Danish and European colleagues. And those are stored at the University of Copenhagen.
So you got to go to both of those places to do your work?
I did, yeah. So I spent, me and another colleague, Olivia Williams, who's still at Oregon State, was very kindly helping me sample ice in a minus 30 degrees Celsius freezer for 3 weeks.
Right,
because
it has to stay frozen, right? And so then you have to basically operate in frozen conditions.
Yeah, it was. And it's actually almost worse than working in the field because your body never quite gets used to the cold.
Right.
So you're always in and out. It's actually quite difficult work.
How long did it take for you to collect that data? Like, is that a week process or is this months?
Yeah, so it took about 3 weeks to process the samples. So take them from their larger cores into samples that we can measure. And then I was able to measure the data over about 4 to 5 months in the lab.
You described this transect, and mm-hmm. Is there a reason why you chose that transect? Are there other areas you could have sampled from? Was there a reason for that those particular locations?
So most ice cores are drilled along what we would call a divide. So it's a hydrological divide, which is effectively controlling how the ice is flowing. So along the divide, so along that mountain range that runs under Greenland, the ice is going to be flowing away from it equally in both directions. So it actually makes the stratigraphy, so the layering of the ice, is very normal. You know, they're relatively well spaced. You're not getting folds or complex flow. So you're kind of actually limited to collecting ice along that divide. And there really hasn't been a lot of work farther south than the summit of Greenland for some time. So that's kind of a new project that hopefully might happen in 2040 at this point, to try to collect some ice from farther south in Greenland. So it's partly what's available and what locations have the correct ice to kind of tell the story.
I also saw that you were using other information like pollen to determine what plants were doing. Can you talk about some other data sets that you may have actually used in the methodology?
Mm-hmm. So I didn't make any of those measurements. They were done by in other studies. So this was kind of more of a comparison to think about what other parts of Greenland away from the ice sheet was doing. So thinking about smaller glacier systems, what were, lakes, marsh systems near the base of the ice sheet responding to at this time. So I was really trying to expand this study from just being focused on ice cores to actually what's the wider range of Arctic climate records. So how can we compare and contrast what we're seeing against what they're seeing? And then can that inform our big picture of what this period of climate change was going on in the Arctic?
Yeah, that's so interesting. And I always think it's so helpful for people to understand, too, that we don't really operate in isolation, that we do use other data sets to help us inform us about what's going on in our own data sets. So mm-hmm. that is a good thing. So go ahead. Yep.
That actually came up as part of the review process.
Mm.
So a lot of that, the first draft of this manuscript was relatively more focused on ice cores. And one of the reviewers was very correctly brought up that there's so much more information out there during this time period that's coming from these lesser known proxies that are, the work was done incredibly well. It just hasn't been as widely used or compared to for ice core science. And that was a big part of their critique. And that they suggested that I add. So I think that really helped strengthen the paper through that peer review process.
Yeah. And that's going back to our earlier discussion about peer review. A lot of times our reviewers can make huge impacts on what ends up happening in the ultimate product. There's been times where people have criticized how I've analyzed data. So I have to go back and use other methodologies. And that is important because it does strengthen the research. And I know some journals, Frontiers being one of them, ends up publishing ultimately the names of the reviewers on the paper. That's a little bit more rare, but it mm-hmm. is starting to happen so that even though we're not getting paid, at least we're getting acknowledged for some of the contributions that we make. And so that is one thing that, we can all do in order to help, raise the profile of what we're doing here. Yep. and the contributions that we're making to other people's research even. Okay, so I think we're going to move on now to the results. And for the results, we are going to move to your figures. So this, mm-hmm. if people, and I will provide a link to the paper in the description of the podcast. So this is a picture of the map of where you were sampling, Is that right? And then the elevation is based on this kind of heat map, we'll say, down here at the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so it looks like the JISP 2 is the highest elevation at about 3,000 meters.
Yeah, and then you decrease as you go towards the northwest. So Northgrip is kind of this intermediate site, and then Neem is the lowest elevation site.
Very good. And then the other part of this figure is going back to, I think, what you were talking about earlier, which is the delta age is the bottom. The middle is the nitrogen isotope content. And then the top one is the methane content. So one thing that I saw when I was going over this was there's this really big change here around, 15,000 years ago? Is that right? And then we see another big change at about, 11?
Yeah, it's like 11.7 thousand years ago.
So what was going on there?
So that 11.7, that's right in the middle, is the onset of the Holocene. So this kind of period left, or so older than 11.7, so about 11.7 to 20,000 years ago, this is really that period of deglaciation, where we're transitioning from that strong glacial climate towards a climate more like today. And superimposed on this is what we would call millennial scale climate variability. So this is actually mostly what I study, is these relatively abrupt, strong climate changes that happen during glacial periods. So that feature that you pointed out, that's around 14,000 years ago, is the Bolling-Alerod warming, or the first Dansgaard-Oeschger event, so the DO1. And this is a phenomenon that we see occur during really strong glacial periods. So it's kind of this rapid oscillation between warm and cold temperatures. And this is, you know, kind of the last hurrah of millennial scale climate variability during the deglaciation. And it's preceded by this period called the Heinrich Stadial. So it's a Heinrich Stadial one that's kind of shown by that blue bar between about 18,000 years ago and about 15,000 years ago. And this is a period of abrupt cooling that's associated with these armadas of icebergs being released in the North Atlantic. And that's originally what we were trying to study with this paper. And we had a few issues that ran into our methane analysis and some of our nitrogen analysis. So that's kind of where one of the pivots happened.
So I see in the top, the methane, where we're at today, or, you know, close to today, is well above the last maximum when we, you know, are at the end of that, or at the beginning of this interglacial period. But I'm not seeing, you know, we haven't quite seen the exact temperature anomaly. Do you predict that we will eventually see a temperature anomaly?
Yeah, and we have seen a temperature anomaly in Greenland. Part of this cutoff is the data is for this fern temperature anomaly is kind of tuned towards the pre-industrial period. So it's the, you know, roughly around 1850. So we're actually trying to exclude the modern temperature anomaly just so we can have a stable background to compare these results against to. Toward the Greenland methane record, the modern methane concentration is higher than is currently on this plot, but just to kind of keep the scaling reasonable, that's excluded. And, you know, in 100 to 200 years, we could see the modern temperature anomaly within the Greenland cores from this method. You just need to go through that process of fern densification to track those signals, which we haven't quite seen yet.
Got it, got it. And then I'm curious about the nitrogen isotope data. So I see here, you know, right before the early Holocene, there's some peaks, and then it comes down. Is that what we would expect as warming occurs?
So the processes driving changes in the nitrogen isotope concentrations, we have a thermal fractionation and a gravitational fractionation. So fractionation, it just means you're separating out these heavy versus light isotopes. And we're doing that either by the temperature difference between the surface and where those bubbles are being trapped. So if you have an abrupt warming at the surface, so say where methane increases really rapidly at about 15,000 years ago, we have that first peak in nitrogen. So that's being driven by this very strong thermal gradient. So the surface becomes very warm, but snow is really, really well insulating. So the base of the fern, where you're trapping those air bubbles, stays relatively cold. So you would drive a gas gradient through there because of the temperature. But as you go from the relatively cold conditions during the glacial period, so between about 20 to 16,000 years ago, again, you're very cold. There's not a lot of accumulation. So where you're trapping the bubbles will be closer to the surface. So you have a shallower fern layer. And then that'll drive it, you'll have a deeper fern layer. So you're going to be having a greater gravitational fractionation. As you go towards a climate more like today, where it's warmer, there's more precipitation, that becomes deeper, and then you'd have less, or becomes shallower, and you have less gravitational fractionation.
That is so interesting. And so I think we'll move on to the next figure. So can you explain for us what these different colors are here and like the figure legend?
Yeah, absolutely. So what this figure is, it's trying to compare our reconstructions against different proxy reconstructions and against different model simulations. So for the middle panel, the different colors are kind of representing different proxy systems. So I kind of split it between terrestrial reconstructions, so things that we can measure from land, versus what our measurements of things going on in the ocean are. So for the relatively warmer colors, so the reds, the golds, kind of the purple, the dark purple, those are representing more terrestrial, to where the cool colors are representing more of the marine.
So the question I think a lot of people might have is, what are some of these data sets? Are you pulling from tree rings, ocean sediments?
So for the terrestrial, there are a blend. So a lot of them are coming from pollen over this time period. So it's effectively seeing if we have a lot of species of plants that do really well in warm conditions, we know the temperature range today that they like to grow in. If we see a lot of those plants pop up at a certain time, we know that time period must have a temperature similar to that. If we see more cold species, or we see just a change in the distribution of species, we can kind of tell the change in temperature from that. I'm sure there are tree rings also in that reconstruction, which often uses the oxygen isotope composition of the wood itself. There's also information from the carbon isotopes of the wood. Additionally, just the thickness of those tree rings can tell you a lot about climate at the time. And that really makes up the bulk of the terrestrial proxies. For the marine proxies, it is often marine sediments and the composition of foraminifera. So these little tiny marine organisms, which have, you know, very similar to the terrestrial proxies. You can look at the composition of those organisms. So there's more warm water dwelling species or more cold water, along with their isotopic composition.
Very good. And so then what is the top part of this panel telling us?
So the top part of that panel is our fern temperature reconstructions that we produce as part of this paper. And it's just zoomed in and scaled a little differently so we can have a better comparison against these other reconstructions.
Very good. And then we do have model data down here on the bottom. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. So what do models do for us?
So models are really key. Proxies can tell us directly what happened in the past, but models are really how we make sense of them. Mm-hmm. So looking at the models, we can see, okay, is the change in orbital cycles more important? Is the change in the ice sheet thickness the most important thing? What was the atmosphere and circulation doing in other parts? It's kind of really helping us fill in the gaps between what we're seeing in the proxy data and how those changes are being communicated elsewhere.
Yeah, that it's weird. It's like it's a prediction, but it's in the past, right? So
yeah.
A lot of times in ecology, we use models to make predictions about what's going to happen in the future. But I love this because you can make predictions about what you think would have been happening in the past and then compare that to the proxy record, which is actual data that you're collecting from the ice cores. So
that yeah, absolutely.
Is really, really powerful to be able to tell us, okay, now we can have confidence in these models and we're more confident about what the predictions are moving forward with those same models.
Yeah, the paleoclimate research is really this natural laboratory to test our understanding of models and our understanding of underlying climate.
And so the next figure Can you explain what's going on here? And I'm really interested about this brittle ice. What's going on there? Yeah.
So this panel is more of an ice core centric panel. So within the ice core community, this period of really early Holocene warmth was kind of viewed as a response to changing ice sheet elevation. So the total thickness of the ice sheet is really strongly changing over this time period. Mm-hmm. And as you go from being high up in the atmosphere to being lower in the atmosphere, you will have a natural warming that occurs just through the adiabatic lapse rate. Mm-hmm. So this was kind of trying to diagnose, are the things that we're seeing caused by that change in elevation or not? Mm-hmm. So we use a different proxy that we generate at the same time, which is the total air content. So that's the panel C or TAC. And what this is that it's the actual measurement of air that's in the bubbles. So as you change in elevation, you're going to be changing air pressure, which will change the total amount of air that you actually have. So what we're trying to do here is look at what's the difference in air content between our northernmost site, which is at the lowest elevation, and our southernmost site, which is at the highest elevation, to see if the difference in air content and the difference in air pressure can tell us if we are increasing or lowering our relative elevations.
And then brittle ice, does that mean that during that period, there's ice that's more brittle that was formed?
So the brittle ice, it's a phenomenon of really big ice sheets. So while you're in the upper 700 meters, you have air in bubbles. But eventually the pressure of all that ice above you becomes so great that you push the air bubble into the ice crystal itself. Mm. And this is called a clathrate. So the bubble, the gas is still preserved, but it's just being protected by the ice crystal itself. And as it's going through this transition zone, because it's such a dynamic change to like the matrix of the ice itself, the ice becomes incredibly brittle. So when we recover this ice, it can crack, it can even like explode effectively on its own, which leads to problems with gas loss because you're like preferentially releasing air from bubbles rather than the ice matrix itself. So it can make this specific measurement across this period very challenging. So we kind of have to exclude data from that region. And this is just denoting where that location is.
Very good. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing now because I think that was the last figure. Is that right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And so we're now at the beginning of the discussion. We've gone over our results. Can you just take a step back and tell us then what was the sum total of what you found in this research study?
So the sum total of what we found was that we were able to identify this really strong period of warming in the early Holocene at all three of our sites. But the timing of that period was different between them. So the southernmost site at GISP 2 at the summit had that period happen really, really early and very strongly. And then as you go towards the north, it becomes later and later and later. The magnitude, so the total amount of warming, was roughly the same. It just seemed to be delayed by thousands of years in the north. And through that last figure, looking at the total air content, we're pretty certain that that difference wasn't caused by elevation changes. So it's kind of reflecting this broader climate scale phenomenon rather than just a process associated with the ice sheet.
And do you think that the reason why you saw that is because as we go further north, it's a little bit more protected from a warming trend?
It very well could be. So that was one of the other ideas, is Baffin Bay was still likely covered in sea ice, and the ice sheets were really, keeping that region well protected, well insulated. And it's only around 6,000 years ago in the mid-Holocene when that breaks up and you expose it to normal conditions. Another phenomenon that we've observed in Antarctica is that higher elevation locations tend to warm more strongly than low elevation locations. And this is likely associated with the lapse rate. So the lapse rate is the change in temperature as you go in elevation. So that's why you cool as you go higher into the atmosphere. And that can be really strongly dependent on the total amount of moisture in the atmosphere. It could be dependent on, you know, high level heat flow where you're at and on the Earth can change the lapse rate. And maybe one of the things that we're seeing similar to Antarctica is this same phenomenon in Greenland, to where the lapse rate changed between the last ice age and today. And we are actually kind of capturing that transition to where the higher elevation locations are undergoing a stronger warming simply because the lapse rate is changing.
I was just going to ask, and so in this paper, you're measuring methane. How does your work in this time period in Greenland compare to the things that were happening in Antarctica during the same time period?
Methane is largely being produced in the tropics. So we're actually seeing roughly the same signals in Greenland as we do in Antarctica, because they're both kind of taking a, you know, effectively a picture of the same thing that's happening in the tropics. But climate in Antarctica through this period isn't necessarily having these same millennial scale features, but the background climate change is the same. So we're still undergoing this period of strong warming as we transition from the last ice age towards today, but we don't necessarily have that really strong period of early Holocene warmth.
Yeah, and a lot of my students have questions about the fact that there is asymmetry when we look at the warming heat maps in current, you know, what's going on currently. We see a much stronger signal happening in the north, in the Arctic, than we do in Antarctic regions. Can you talk a little bit about why you think that might be happening?
That's kind of a two-part process. So part of that has to do with the amount of landmass that's in the northern hemisphere versus the southern hemisphere. So the north has much more land and a little bit less ocean, and land has a lower thermal inertia. So you can really change the temperature on land a lot more than you can in the ocean. To where the southern hemisphere is a lot of ocean, a lot less land. So that's kind of a more sluggish system. The second part of that has to do with ocean circulation. So in the Atlantic, you're actually transferring a lot of warm water from the southern hemisphere and near the equator up north through the Gulf Stream. This is kind of this northward branch of what we call the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation. So you kind of have this hose of warm water that's going to the northern hemisphere. And this is actually a key part of those millennial scale climate changes that we see during the glacial period. Toward that is really the beating heart of climate change in the past natural timescales, but it still makes up an important part of what we're seeing today.
And I know I've seen a lot of James Balog's work. I always feature his work in my classes because I think the picture evidence of what's going on with the glaciers is really, really critical to people understanding the scale that we're dealing with right now.
Yeah.
But so we do know that the glaciers are melting currently and at a very, very rapid pace. Are you concerned at all about trying to make sure that we get data before data is gone?
Yeah, absolutely. So I kind of mentioned towards the start of this, we also look at ice from places not in Greenland or Antarctica. So I have a lot of colleagues. So one is Dr. Lonnie Thompson at Ohio State University and his group, who have really been trying to go around and collect ice from tropical glaciers that are preserving gas that are melting and being lost today. So these are some of the last archives of these very, very important data, you know, data points, these beautiful systems that are being lost today under anthropogenic climate change. And it's so critical that we study these systems before they're gone to really get an understanding of all these past stories they can tell us.
Yeah. And so a tropical glacier seems like an oxymoron.
It really does.
Where are these things at?
Yeah. So the key to a tropical glacier is just to be incredibly high up in the atmosphere. There's just gigantic mountains. So there's ice from, say, Kilimanjaro. There's ice from the Andes. So it's like the Huascarán glaciers. There's some ice in the Himalayas. So again, you just need to be at very, very high elevation. So they're very challenging places to get to. It's almost harder to get to than Greenland or Antarctica. Again, because they're tropical, they're so sensitive to these climate changes. So it's a ton of work that they're undertaking.
Probably trying to rapidly collect as much data as they can before it's gone. Yeah.
Yeah. And make sure that it's, you know, being preserved and it's being stored in a facility that can really take care of them for, you know, decades to come.
And so I'm going to ask a question that, you know, a lot of people ask me, which is, how do we know that the current warming trends are the result of human activity?
Yeah, I mean, a part of that is we can really clearly see what's happened in the past. And a massive part of that is that we understand the drivers and the mechanisms behind glacial to interglacial climate change. So it's, you know, a climate change that we today can hardly fathom of hundreds, 100 meters of sea level change, like significant changes in every system across the globe. And that is due to roughly the same amount of CO2 that we put in the atmosphere in a tenth of the time. So we're kind of taking this geologic timescale phenomenon and we're putting onto a human timescale that we can see, you know, from 800,000 years ago, or I guess 1.2 million years ago, towards today, we can see that transition happen before our very eyes. And being able to look at the past to understand, you know, how is this transition occurring? Where could it go? And where could it go if we either change our behavior or if we don't change our behavior? And that's such an important part of paleoclimate science and climate science in general.
Yes, I know. And so we do talk a lot about that. I know there's a lot of areas around the world that are starting to try to prepare for a sea level rise. I have strong ties to the Florida Keys. I have research projects down there, and I have an aunt and uncle that have lived there for over 40 years. And so they have seen firsthand what's going on. And Monroe County down there has already got a task force to try to figure out how they're going to mitigate for the sea level rise, because many of those islands are predicted to be underwater within the next 100 years. So, all right. So what is the next steps for this particular research project, or have you moved on to something new with your postdoc?
One other related to this work that I've been working on is there are a couple small millennial scale climate changes that happened during the Holocene. One of them is called the 8.2K event, and it's this period of cooling. So it's this little cooling blip that occurs during the Holocene thermal maximum. So trying to understand what the ice core record can tell us about that event is something that I'm working on. I'm also looking at changes in mean ocean temperature during my postdoc. And that's another thing that we can tell from ice cores based off of noble gases. That's fit many podcasts of its own trying to talk about that. But I'm still trying to stay in the ice core realm, but I'm kind of feeling the pull of paleoceanography.
Well, you're at Woods Hole. So
yes. Yeah. It's hard to avoid.
Right. Yes. And that, but you know, there's so much good work being done in the oceans. There's a lot of work that I show my students from the plankton people, you know, how are increased sea surface temperatures changing and impacting the plankton communities, which of course are really important because for anybody that doesn't know, 50% of the oxygen that we breathe is produced by actually the phytoplankton on the ocean surface. And a lot of people think, oh, it's the rainforest. And yes, they do produce forests and plants, terrestrial plants produce a lot of oxygen for us, but actually the number one producer is phytoplankton. And without phytoplankton, we are in serious trouble because we won't have the oxygen levels that we have today. And so I like to show them a lot of that work that comes out of, you know, oceanography in order to show them that it's not just, you know, in ice that we can see things happening. And I've also told them that, you know, the two groups of scientists as in the, you know, 70s and 80s and 90s that were the first people to start sounding the alarms were people that studied glaciers and people that studied coral. So they're two really important groups of scientists that were saying the same thing long, long before the scientific community was really kind of, oh, we need to start focusing on this because this is a problem.
Yeah, absolutely.
But all right, very good. Well, I'm going to end with one last question, and that is, what is your biggest unanswered questions in the field of global climate change?
Oh my goodness. That's a really good question. You know,
my PhD advisor would ask us this at the end of lab meeting. So now this is my turn to impose it on others.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my big question. It's certainly, I don't think, the biggest question in paleoclimatology, but I am still just fascinated with Heinrich events, which are those big armadas of ice being released during some of the coldest conditions we have on the planet. And they have these widespread disruptions to tropical hydrology. Antarctica becomes incredibly warm. There are these really, really enigmatic and relatively understudied periods. And I think it tells us a lot about the interactions between ocean circulation and global climate. And that's really that's what my PhD was mostly on. And I still think all those questions remain open.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, me too.
And I look forward to, of course, keeping up with your work. Is there some place that we can see you on the socials?
No, I've managed to kind of stay off socials.
So your scientific papers in Google Scholar.
Yes, pretty much.
Very, very good. Very good. Well, I always end the podcast with saying, when science talks, we listen.